Sackler name. And it was really interesting to see this process play out. You know, I wrote this piece. There were other articles. There was a lot of media attention around the Sacklers in late 2017. But at first, you know, I called all these museums and they said, we're not doing anything. We're not taking this down. This isn't our business. I called universities, you know, Yale. You know, they said, no, thank you. And then the activism started. And, you know, there had always been activism, but, you know, Nan Golden in particular in the art world conducted a series of really public actions that got a lot of media attention and really hit the Sacklers where it hurt. And she, you know, using her own influence in the art world and gathering all these people together, essentially forced a lot of museums to take down the name.
Chris Glazek, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to talk about that activism in part two. Thank you so much for being with us, investigative reporter, and Ed Bish, founder of Relatives Against Purdue Pharma. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
It's 5:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Up next, we have the evening news, followed at 5:30 by Counterspin.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland will not be adding gunshot detection technology to its streets anytime soon.
Oregon Democratic lawmakers say they'll fine their Republican counterparts who are on a walkout.
And Oregonians rally to support a bill to give undocumented residents food assistance.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 2nd, 2023. I'm Sam Jones.
And I'm Althea Billings. Portland will not be adding gunshot detection technology to its streets anytime soon. Mayor Ted Wheeler announced the reversal on Thursday, saying the city doesn't have the time, money, bandwidth, or personnel to add a gunshot detection pilot project. One gunshot detection contractor, Sound Thinking, formerly ShotSpotter, spent months courting Portland Police Bureau members to sell their technology to the city. Community feedback to the proposed project was negative. Wheeler described the split as 60-40, so no more pilot project. Instead, Wheeler announced Portland's ceasefire to respond to the gun violence epidemic in the city. Portland's ceasefire would unite various city programs that deal with gun violence and increase street-level outreach. That approach has seen some mixed success in other cities, but it can be difficult to measure exactly. Outreach efforts like this use workers called violence interrupters who have experience in gangs or with gun violence. The idea is to have folks with credibility reach out to people at risk of being involved in gun violence and help mediate. Gun violence in Portland surged in 2020, and officials scrambled to respond. Wheeler pointed to some successes, like in the entertainment district, where he credits a dramatic decrease in shootings to changes to the flow of traffic, police foot patrols, and better lighting.
Oregon Democratic senators plan to fine their missing Republican colleagues $325 a day for their ongoing walkout. Republicans have been missing from the state legislature for nearly a month, grinding business to a halt. They're in the minority, but their presence in the State House is necessary for quorum. Two-thirds of lawmakers have to be present in order for the Senate to vote on important bills. Republican senators don't have the numbers to vote down bills like House Bill 2002, so they've walked out instead. House Bill 2002 would protect health care providers who give abortions and require insurance companies to cover gender-affirming care. The absent senators have already reached the 10-day unexcused absence limit created by Measure 113, meaning they can't seek re-election. Republicans say they plan to challenge that in court. As for the fines for their absence, State Senate President Rob Wagner says they'll begin on Monday, June 5th, at 10:30 a.m. Everyday senators don't show up for work. They'll get a $325 fine. Here are some of Wagner's remarks from the Senate floor on Thursday.
Each of these bills deserves a vote on the Senate floor. Our voters demand it. The Constitution requires it. The only reason that they are not is that a minority of members are blocking the will of the people in opposition to legislation they personally don't like, starting with the protection of Oregonians' reproductive freedom in the wake of Roe v. Wade. We provided some room this past week. The governor engaged in lengthy negotiations to help broker a deal and also remind the minority of their constitutional obligation. And yesterday, the governor issued a statement detailing all the work and the time spent in a good faith effort to boost the legislative priorities of the minority. That effort was not met in good faith. Sometimes in a democracy, we have tough issues to talk about, and that is okay. It's a clashing of worldviews that impact the lives of Oregonians, and that includes reproductive freedom. This is important legislation that will help vulnerable Oregonians. And we see that the minority wants to kill a bill that has the support of the members of this body representing their constituencies and the majority of Oregonians. And folks, that isn't a democracy. And that is a violation of our senator's sacred constitutional oath. We have had people walk off the job from this floor for a month. Oregonians work for a living every day. And they don't get paid when they don't show up.
That was Oregon Senate President Rob Wagner speaking on the Senate floor Thursday. Democratic lawmakers say they intend to start collecting the fine from their missing Republican colleagues on Monday.
Oregonians gathered in Salem to show their support for a bill that would provide food assistance to people who are currently excluded because of their immigration status. The bill would help about 62,000 people get access to aid. Eric Tagadoff spoke with Morgan Dewey from the Oregon Food Bank to learn more.
A rally was held in Salem on Thursday to urge passage of a bill that would provide food assistance to Oregonians regardless of their immigration status. Senate Bill 610, known as Food for All Oregonians, would ensure people who are undocumented and excluded from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program receive food aid in the state. Morgan Dewey is with Oregon Food Bank.
The Capitol was a beautiful backdrop for a series of speakers who shared their personal stories, organizations that are part of the 125-plus organization-led coalition supporting Food for All Oregonians.
Senate Bill 610 would extend aid to lawful permanent residents, U.S. Compacts of Free Association citizens, and other Oregonians who arrived as immigrants or refugees. Dewey says more than a million people are expected to access food assistance this year. To help counteract that, SB 610 would help get aid to about 62,000 Oregonians.
With food on the table, families can thrive. Kids can do better in school. Access to education and health care and housing becomes a little less of a worry.
The biggest roadblock for the bill's passage is the Senate Republicans' walkout. Dewey says anti-hunger advocates are urging them to return to Salem.
We're really calling on folks to come back and do their jobs so that pieces of legislation that will support a thriving Oregon, like SB 610, Food for All Oregonians, can pass and support our neighbors and our communities.
This is the final installment of a four-part series focused on food assistance for people who are immigrants. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Contract negotiations between the Portland Public School District and the Portland Association of Teachers are heating up. Last week, teachers demonstrated in support of their union's requests for smaller class sizes, racial equity, restorative justice, reduced testing, and expanded mental health services. KBOO's Isabel Charlet is an educator and union member, as well as a reporter. She filed this report from last week's rally.
More testing! No race! No contract! No peace! No contract! No peace! Hundreds of educators and their supporters gathered outside the PPS board meeting last week to demand better pay, working conditions, and learning conditions for students. The Teachers Union, Portland Association of Teachers, has been in contract negotiations with the district since January. And with the board getting closer to their final vote on next year's budget, energy is picking up. This is an educator speaking about the particularly rough conditions faced by teachers and students of color at Ockley Green Middle School in North Portland.
In addition to the facilities being unteachable, they cannot learn in these facilities. They have rats. They have carbon dioxide. Ockley Green is being dismantled. Teachers are leaving. Teachers of color don't want to be there. And kids, 77 kids have left this year because it is unsafe. Please, love on our kids. Support teachers of color.
The school board says declining enrollment, paired with the follow-up loss of funding from the state, makes many of the changes the union is asking for challenging. But the president of the PAT, Angela Bonilla, says what they're fighting for is fundamental.
No mold and rodents in our buildings. Temperatures between 60 and 90 degrees. We're asking for class size caps and caseload caps so our educators don't keep leaving the district because it is unsustainable. We're asking for mental health teams post-COVID in every single school. So it seems like if they don't have the money, we got to find the money. And yet, every time I hear about school safety, I hear, we will find the money, we will figure it out. So we have the money to bring, you know, armed guards into our schools, but we don't have the money to make sure that we have mental health professionals to avoid those types of incidents. Make the math make sense, right?
The board did recently approve a 2.5% pay increase for cost of living, but union members say in order to keep up with inflation, educators need an 8.5% cost of living increase. This is an educational assistant, or EA, who spoke at the rally.
Why is it at nighttime de-escalating kids who are ripping posters off of walls? I de-escalate kids who are crawling on bathroom stalls. I spend my time talking to autistic and ADHD kids during class when they're having a really rough time. I find creative ways to explain difficult concepts to kids with dyslexia, to kids with auditory processing issues. I try to reach all the kids that you cannot reach when you're in your classroom leading your lesson. And they cut our jobs. I make, to begin with, $17 an hour and 34 cents.
Once the board meeting is set to begin, the crowd squeezes inside the PPS administration building, which is quickly filled beyond capacity. We are told that some of us need to leave to avoid violating fire codes. Some of the teachers I'm standing by joke that it's ironic that now the school board is concerned about the numbers of people in a room being a safety hazard, when they don't seem to show the same concern for class sizes.
Yeah, I mean, at our school, in my program in particular, at my high school, over half of our students are on IEPs or 504s, and we have zero paraeducators in our program to help with that. And these kids, you know, they need a lot of support. And when you're the only adult in the room and you have a classroom that is too full of students and half of them need extra support, there's only so much learning that you can facilitate.
Martha works at Pacific University training teachers and also has two children at PPS.
And as a researcher that focuses on the strategies of how to create better school systems and understands policy and educational policy, it's disappointing that they also know the information that I know and they choose to do the opposite, right? A bunch of the teachers that were here are teachers that I've trained myself, and beyond that, I know their hearts. And I know that they have loved on my children, so how could I not support that? How can I not support them?
Next year's budget is likely to include the layoff of 90 PPS employees, a 3% staff reduction. But the union is not giving up.
But what we saw last year is that when we speak up and we speak out, positions do get renewed. They found money to support our middle schools and provide more support last year for this year. So we're hoping that this advocacy will push them to spend the money we know they have on the things we know we need.
For KBOO News, I'm Isabel Charlet.
The Senate aims to get the debt limit spending bill to President Biden's desk quickly. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis makes a campaign stop in Iowa, and a new survey finds that most straight adults support LGBTQ plus rights. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Is it everything I wanted? No. But sitting with one House, with a Democratic Senate, and a Democratic president who didn't want to meet with us, I think we did pretty dang good for the American public.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said history was made with the passage of the debt limit spending bill in the House. The legislation raises the debt limit until December 2024 and restrains discretionary spending over the next decade. The bill now heads to the Senate. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said they'd get the bill to President Joe Biden's desk as soon as possible.
Time is a luxury the Senate does not have if we want to prevent default. June 5th is less than 4 days away. At this point, any needless delay or any last-minute holdups would be an unnecessary and even dangerous risk.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell welcomed the debt limit spending bill with its projected $1.5 trillion in cuts, saying it makes the most serious headway in years toward curbing Washington Democrats' reckless spending addiction. McConnell called the level of defense spending disappointing.
So while the coming votes are an important step in the right direction, we cannot neglect our fundamental obligation to address the nation's most pressing national security challenges.
The Senate passed a measure to overturn President Biden's student debt relief program, which aimed to forgive up to $20,000 in student loans for more than 40 million people. Observers say the president is likely to veto the bill, in part because elements of the plan remain under consideration by the conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Democratic Senators John Tester of Montana and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, alongside Arizona Independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema, joined Republicans to cut Biden's proposal. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis made his debut as a Republican presidential candidate in Iowa Tuesday, rallying after a glitch-filled launch on Twitter. While DeSantis did not mention former President Donald Trump by name, he intensified his criticism of the former president.
A leadership is not about entertainment. It is not about building a brand. It is not about virtue signaling. Leadership is about producing results for the people that you represent.
On the first day of Pride Month, Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes took to Twitter to say it is more important than ever. Elected officials and state offices work to protect and promote the civil rights of LGBTQ plus Arizonans.
I am a supporter and ally, a friend and a family member, and I want to make sure that folks feel good, feel safe, and supported.
According to a new survey by the advocacy group GLAAD, 9 out of 10 heterosexual Americans support LGBTQ plus rights. The organization says it could be a sign the GOP strategy of targeting LGBTQ plus Americans may backfire with voters in upcoming elections. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's the Magical Mystery Tour. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 78. Today in history, in 1966, Surveyor 1 lands on the moon, becoming the first U.S. spacecraft to soft land on another world. The quote of the day is from American musician and key figure in the transition from blues to rock and roll, Bo Diddley, who said, quote, "I thank you in advance for the great round of applause I'm about to get."
A new Ojibwe restaurant opens in Wisconsin. And the University of Alaska Southeast awards an honorary degree to a Juneau elder. With these stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An Ojibwe chef has opened a restaurant in Wisconsin on Lake Superior. Lena Tran of Station WUWM reports.
Mijim is on Madeline Island, a sacred place for Ojibwe people. It's a homecoming for Chef Bryce Stevenson, a member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. He says he wants the place to represent the Red Cliff and Bad River bands, who were forcibly removed from the island.
I want to reclaim a little spot on the island with our traditional foods and to take those foods and just make them accessible.
Mijim's focus is seasonal, serving up meats like venison and bison alongside wild rice, mushrooms, ramps. They aim to source products from native-owned businesses. Stevenson has been cooking since he was young, using commodities like ramen, rice-a-roni.
When things started getting rough for my mom and her marriage, she was working three jobs, night and day, and there was five of us, and I had to cook a lot. You know, I had to cook dinner for my siblings.
He entered the food industry in Milwaukee and worked in fine dining spots across the country. But he always told himself he needed to open a restaurant where he was from.
I just kept putting in my head, like, I have to go back to Red Cliff. I need to open it up where I'm from. I need to, you know, make something like this up there because nothing like it has ever existed.
The island is a summer tourist hotspot. Stevenson says there aren't many expressions of current indigenous culture. With Mijim, he wants to show native people are there and thriving. For National Native News, I'm Lena Tran in Milwaukee.
At college graduation ceremonies across the nation, universities also award honorary doctorates. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, one of those went to an elder in Juneau, Alaska.
Anna Eller's love affair with Thlinkit weaving began as a small child when she saw her uncle in a July 4th parade wearing a Chilkat blanket with fringe that seemed to have a life of its own.
The fringe was very flowing and graceful. The colors and the design, my little four-year-old eyes just fell in love with it. And I knew that's what I wanted to do with my life, was to make those.
It wasn't until 20 years later that she shared her dream with a state lawmaker while working at the state capitol. When Ellers explained she would have to take a year off from work to learn to weave, something she couldn't afford to do, a group of Alaska Native lawmakers got together and wrote a bill to give her a grant equivalent to a year's salary. And it came just in time for Ellers to work under Jenny Clunott, then in her 90s, and a master at using mountain goat wool and cedar bark fiber to weave knowledge that is precious.
Jenny Clunott said we were not to be stingy with the knowledge that she gave us.
Knowledge that Ellers used to teach more than 300 students. A spirit of generosity the University of Alaska Southeast recognized during its graduation ceremony this year.
I'm honored to present Anna Ellers with the Honorary Doctorate of Fine Arts. Congratulations.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Ellers.
Thank you.
And at 68, Dr. Ellers isn't done yet.
The project I'm doing is the biggest Chilkat blanket in the world.
The design is a secret until the blanket goes on a national tour in 2025. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The Kuskokwim Consortium Library in Alaska is being honored by the Institute of Museum and Library Service. Senator Lisa Murkowski nominated the Bethel Library, which provides internet and educational support. It also works to preserve Yupik culture. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Border Patrol medical staff refused to review the file of an 8-year-old girl with a chronic heart condition and rare blood disorder. Then she had a seizure and died on her 9th day in custody. The girl's 9 days in custody far exceeded the agency's own limit of 72 hours. Anadith Alvarez was born in Panama with congenital heart disease. She received surgery 3 years ago that her family characterized as successful, but she still had other chronic medical problems. Alvarez entered Brownsville, Texas, with her parents and two older siblings on May 9th. At that time, daily illegal crossings surpassed 10,000 as migrants tried to beat the end of pandemic-related restrictions on seeking asylum. The child's parents shared her medical history with U.S. Customs and Border Protection authorities on May 10th, a day after the family was taken into custody. She was diagnosed with the flu May 14th at a temporary holding facility and was moved with her family to Harlingen, Texas. A day before she died, Alvarez showed a fever of 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Her family expressed concerns to medical staff over that high fever, flu symptoms, nausea, and breathing difficulties. She was given medications, a cold pack, and a cold shower. But a nurse practitioner declined to review documents about the girl the day she died. The nurse practitioner also denied at least three requests from the girl's mother for an ambulance. A surveillance video system at the station was out of service, a violation of federal law that prevented evidence collection. The system was flagged for repair, but wasn't fixed until May 23rd, 6 days after the girl died. Investigators gave no explanation for decisions that medical staff made. The Office of Professional Responsibility said, quote, "Despite the girl's condition, her mother's concerns, and the series of treatments required to manage her condition, contracted medical personnel did not transfer her to a hospital for higher-level care," end quote. A court-appointed monitor expressed concern in January about chronic conditions of medically fragile children not getting through to Border Patrol staff. Alvarez's mother told the Associated Press that she informed staff of her child's conditions, which included sickle cell anemia. She repeatedly asked for medical assistance and an ambulance. The requests were denied until her child fell unconscious.
The Bozeman-based Greater Yellowstone Coalition is trying to close what it calls a dangerous loophole that could allow a mining company to prospect for gold on the doorstep of the world's first national park. The company has its plans ready, and the coalition is trying to raise money to stave off the mine. Mark Moran reports from Yellowstone.
30,000 acres of Yellowstone National Park are protected from mining by congressional order, but there's a sliver that's not. A Montana nonprofit is trying to change that. The Bozeman-based Greater Yellowstone Coalition wants to close what it sees as a dangerous loophole that could still allow mining to happen on the edge of the world's first national park. The GYC is trying to raise $6.25 million to buy the land and mineral rights on private property in what is known as the Yellowstone Gateway along the northern edge of the park to prevent Crevice Mining Group from prospecting for gold. Coalition Executive Director Scott Christensen says the deal will extinguish the last real and significant mining threat on the border of Yellowstone National Park forever.
Purchasing the mineral rights, the mining leases, the claims that they've staked, the mining permit they have, all of the proprietary plans and exploration information that they have, allowing them to walk away and avoid a mine being built on the boundary of Yellowstone.
Christensen says the coalition has until October 1st to raise the remaining $2.35 million to buy the mining rights, or Crevice will move forward with its plans. In addition to concerns over mining, Crevice Mountain, where the mine is being proposed, is also prime grizzly bear habitat and home to a migration corridor for elk, mule deer, and bighorn sheep. Christensen says wildlife are another reason for concern over a potential mine.
I just have to believe that there are a lot of people out there in our country and really in the world who share the same passion that we do for Yellowstone National Park and this amazing Greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
The coalition website says a mine on Crevice Mountain would permanently alter vital wildlife habitat north of Yellowstone, but could also severely impact the character, water quality, and aesthetic value of much of the park itself. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Mark Moran.
A community-wide geothermal system in Texas provides heating and cooling in a new development. The shared system provides clean heating and cooling to hundreds of homes at once. Dr. Anthony Lisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Summers in Austin, Texas are scorching. But just a little ways underground, it's in the low 70s year-round. Geothermal heating and cooling systems make use of that constant temperature.
You're able to draw on that constant thermal resource that's just below your feet to either pull the heat out of the earth when it is cold or when it's hot to be able to sink the heat from buildings into the earth using a heat pump.
Greg Wolfson of the company EcoSmart Solution says geothermal systems have been around for a long time. they can be expensive and are typically installed one house at a time. But Wolfson's company is taking a different approach. At a new development near Austin called Whisper Valley, his team installed a community-wide geothermal system that provides heating and cooling to more than 400 homes. Underground pipes run through the whole community, with connections to each house, kind of like a municipal water system. He says the shared system is more efficient and cost-effective.
You're creating one large resource that effectively all the homes can draw upon.
So he says it's a way to provide clean heating and cooling to hundreds of new homes all at once. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 2nd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, curiosities, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Moran, Eric Tegedoff, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Sam Jones. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.